This Janet Meffer Today podcast is brought to you by Heart for Lebanon. Heart for Lebanon is bringing food, Christian education, and the gospel of Jesus Christ to the thousands of displaced children flooding into Lebanon's refugee camps. Help the Christian response to terrorism today with a gift of $98. 866-485-9187. 866-485-9187 or janetmefford.com.
This is Janet Meffer Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Meffer.
Thank you so much for joining us again. It was just a few decades ago that President Reagan held a press conference to tell the pornography peddlers of America, your industry's days are numbered. This was a couple of years after the president convened a presidential commission on pornography and years after the culture war on pornography really started to gain steam. But now Politico magazine has written that the culture war on pornography is effectively over and that the battle has been conceded by Republicans. Is that really true? And if so, why is that the case? These are really important questions for us to answer. Joining us now is attorney Patrick Truman. He is president and chief executive officer of the National Center on Sexual Exploitation, the leading national group exposing the links between child sexual abuse, prostitution, sex trafficking, and the public health crisis of pornography. He served as chief of the Child Exploitation and Obscenity Section Criminal Division at the U.S. Department of Justice from 1988 to 1993, supervising the prosecution of child sex crimes, child pornography, and obscenity, and also managed an office of prosecutors. And he is joining us to weigh in on this article called How the GOP Gave Up on Porn. Pat, it is so good to talk to you. Thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Janet.
Well, I know that you and your organization were included in this article, which tries to make the case that there's no real culture war over porn anymore. And I'm really curious to get your perspective on that. Do you think that the GOP has given up on fighting porn?
Well, I think many in the GOP have given up on fighting porn. But there is a great movement, greater than it's ever been, that is fighting on the issue. So what we don't see is the U.S. Department of Justice doing their job. And their job is to prosecute illegal pornography. When a mother finds that her son, young son, has been given pornography on the internet, you know, who is she to blame? You can blame the pornographers, but the Justice Department has given those pornographers a green light by saying, even though we have laws on the books that'll put you away for 5 years, take your business away, we're going to give you a pass to give pornography to every child in America, every man in America, every woman in America. That's not right. But I think that there's hope in the movement that we have created. So the political article has some truth to it, but it doesn't see the movement.
Yes, I think that's really significant. So when you're talking about the DOJ dropping the ball, the next question is obviously, why is the DOJ dropping the ball? I know we have Jeff Sessions leaving that position, but what gives? Why in the world wouldn't they go after these illegal pornographers? It doesn't seem to be very sensible, other than the fact that maybe they don't have the resources, which seems to be one of the factors.
No, they have the resources. You know, Janet, when I was in charge of the prosecution of illegal pornography, adult and child sex crimes at the Department of Justice, we made money. And people used to criticize us. Oh, we don't have money for pornography prosecutions. We should put it into more important things like prosecuting corporations or oil companies. They always had a reason. But during the years that I was there, 5 years, we spent less than $20 million and brought in $28 million to the Justice Department. Because when you convict these pornographers who are very wealthy, you take the property, the ill-gotten gain from their crimes, and you fine them. And that could be, for each one, $1 million or more dollars.
Wow.
And the truth is, when these cases get before juries, the jurors convict pornographers because they don't like them. And that article on Politico makes that point, that people have a visceral reaction against pornography. We don't even talk about it in polite society. And people recognize it, especially in this Me Too culture that we're living in. They recognize that pornography is the sexual exploitation of women primarily. And so they will convict. So there's no reason for the Justice Department not to do it except they don't want the criticism. Because doing the right thing often comes with lots of criticism. Ask former Attorney General Ed Meese from the Reagan administration.
Right, right, exactly. Well, how do you compare the days of, you know, when you had the Meese report and when you had the big fight against pornography and Politico gets into Jerry Falwell's objections to Jimmy Carter doing the Playboy interview and going back in time versus now? Because they seem to be making the point that in an internet age, it's futile to even fight porn. And that's, could, you know, that could be one of the reasons that people have given up on the issue, at least in the political realm. Do you have any theories on why in the political realm it doesn't seem to come up as much as it once did?
Yeah, I think it's true that it doesn't come up as often as it once did. And that's probably because of the widespread use of pornography.
Yeah.
It has become so widespread that, it, as one researcher said, it's become the wallpaper of our children's lives. And people think you can't do something about it. If you ask the average person on the street, should pornography be banned? They would say, well, I don't think so, or yeah, maybe. The fact is, it is banned. Illegal pornography is illegal, the hardcore pornography, in America. 45 states have laws prohibiting retail distribution, and the federal government prohibits the distribution of hardcore pornography by mail, by internet, by satellite, cable TV, wholesale, by retail shops, etc. And one person stands in the way of the enforcement of these laws. No one back when I was enforcing the law said, had that discussion about whether it should be banned or not, because people understood it was illegal because we were bringing in prosecutions every month, getting convictions. So, you know, the law is a great teacher, Janet, and when you enforce the law, people say there's something wrong with it. And that's what's the problem with this whole issue of pornography. We let the pornographers run wild and we don't enforce the law.
Yeah, it's so true. And you mentioned something which I think is very significant to the discussion, which is the Me Too movement. I mean, we have this renewed interest in the exploitation of women through Me Too and harassment and sexual abuse and all the rest. We also have the issue of child sex trafficking, which has become a big issue in the last few years. So why not look at, I mean, why can't we get people on the side of the Me Too and the child trafficking issue to renew this as a big fight? Because it was the case, wasn't it, that feminists used to be against pornography? Now they see it as empowerment. I mean, how do we get those movements of old to renew their interest in banning porn and enforcing the law?
Well, some feminists don't see it as a problem, but the radical feminists do. When we have our annual conference, this summit, we get a lot of the feminists and radical feminists coming because there's still a great movement there, and they've joined together with religious conservatives to fight pornography. The reason is pornography leads to sexual violence against women.
Yeah.
You know, there's a study out indicating of the top 50 porn films just a few years ago, the top 50 porn films sold in America, 88% of the scenes depicted sexual violence against women.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what pornography has become today. So there's reason why the feminists are involved. But there's another point here. The research is almost entirely on our side on the harms of pornography. We talk about the public health crisis of pornography because we can see that sexual violence is on the rise, tied to sexual violence, the rape culture on the college campuses, the military sexual assault crisis. There's a new crisis in America called child-on-child sex abuse, and the only reason for it, or virtually the only reason, is that children are now consuming pornography, and they act out what they see on other children. Janet, there's every reason to enforce the laws on pornography.
Right. So is it your opinion, if the DOJ suddenly turned around and began enforcing the law, that they would be buried with criticism, or do you think they would actually find a lot more support than they anticipate?
Well, I think they'd get both. I think they'd get a lot more support because the harms of pornography now have reached virtually every family in America. If your family hasn't been harmed by it, then you're worried about the harm. If you're a parent with kids, 10, 11, you're thinking, oh my gosh, how do I protect my kids? Because they get it on the playground, they get it at their friend's house, they get it on your laptop, etc. But I really think that people would see, if you took down the pornographers with prosecution, there'd be a lot of support for those who are doing that.
Right. We'll be right back with Pat Truman. You're listening to Janet Mefford Today. Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to their health care? As a Christian, are you looking for health care that doesn't violate your morals and convictions? We're happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a community of like-minded Christians who work together to pay for their medical costs. It allows you to decide how, when, and where you'll access health care, so you can make the best choice for you and your family. Starting at $199 per month for a single, up to $529 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all the kids. This is how healthcare should be. For more information, call 855-585-4237 or visit libertyhealthshare.org. That's libertyhealthshare.org. Regain control over your healthcare costs. Together, we're changing healthcare for good. That number again, 855-585-4237 or visit libertyhealthshare.org. How can Christians stand on God's word at a time when radical activists want to compromise the church on the issue of biblical sexuality? A rising tide of LGBT activism is becoming apparent inside our churches. Wearing a religious facade, these activists talk about LGBT Christians and sexual minorities, and their goal is to move our churches away from the word of God. It's time for the church to defend biblical truth without compromise. That's why I'd like to invite you to join me, Janet Mefford, at the God's Voice Conference, a biblical response to the queering of the church. Sponsored by First Stone Ministries, God's Voice will bring clarity to the confusion surrounding revoiced sexuality and identity. Our team of experts will demonstrate how the language of the LGBT Christian movement is rooted not in the Bible, but in the same ideology that has wreaked havoc on our culture. The God's Voice Conference will take place February 22nd and 23rd in Oklahoma City, and we want to see you there. It's time for the church to bow the knee to God's voice. To register or for more information, visit godsvoice.us. That's godsvoice.us. We are back on Janet Mefford Today. Thank you for joining us, talking about the Politico magazine piece recently printed, How the GOP Gave Up on Porn. They write, once the fight against pornography was the beating heart of the American culture war. Now porn is a ballooning industry and maybe a harmful one with no real opponents. What happened? Well, Patrick Truman is with us. He is definitely an opponent. He's the president and chief executive officer of the National Center on Sexual Exploitation and has a very long and impressive record on fighting porn and obscenity in public life. So we were talking a little bit about how the DOJ is not enforcing the law, Pat, and you had mentioned in the article, you were quoted in this article as saying what happened in the porn fight. You mentioned the rise of the internet, but you also talked about the Clinton presidency. How was that a turning point historically on the porn war as it is?
Well, when Bill Clinton got in, the internet really got started on its own. That it hadn't been popularized, but it was popularized then. And I had been moved out of the Justice Department because I was a political appointee of the Republican Party. And so I went back to my old office and I said, you guys have to start prosecuting this new tool, the internet pornographers. They're going to move all their operations to the internet. And of course that happened. But the Clinton administration had a phrase that they would repeat over and over again, hands off the net. They wanted to see the internet develop without any regulation, et cetera. So the pornographers, given a green light, moved to the internet, and they've been free there ever since. And, you know, that's the problem.
Right. It's awful. Well, and you...
And, of course, you had Bill Clinton's own foibles. We don't have to detail those. But that didn't help either.
Right. Well, now, what about President Trump? Because people have pointed out his own lifestyle. And is that maybe a factor here?
Well, it may be a factor in that the Justice Department is reluctant to get vigorous in prosecuting because, after all, apparently President Trump was having sex with a porn star or maybe more than one, etc. But that's no excuse. You know, we don't expect much more morally from our presidents over the last decade or, yeah. or two.
Right. No,
and,
I know.
but the American public does not want to have the pornographers in their homes. That's a message that is certain. All the harm that it causes to children, to spouses, so many marriages break up as a result of pornography. A lot of your listeners who are hearing this now can relate to that. The husbands all but committing adultery if he's looking at pornography.
Yeah.
And it leads to a great many harms. So the Attorney General of the United States should enforce the law. If they don't enforce the law, then you know what they're saying is that pornographers are welcome in every home in America. But when you vigorously enforce the law, Janet, this is the lesson that we learned in the Reagan and Bush 1 administrations. What happens to the pornographers is that they shrink back. They won't ship their material to areas of the country where there are prosecutions, and they'll change the nature of the pornography that they produce. A lot of what you see today is incest porn, it's sexual violence, etc. They won't produce that because they know that it'll get a conviction. Now, a lot of the porn today has changed because it's on the internet rather than in your porn shops. And people always will tell me, well, how are you going to prosecute all those pornographers on the internet? Studies have shown that most of those pornographers on the internet are related down to one or just a handful of companies. I won't say one, a handful of companies. You could manage a prosecution task force going after the top 50 or 60, and you'd clean up the internet. But you have to have the courage to do so.
Well, I can think of a lot of parents I know, and I'm one of them. I had an experience with my daughter years ago where she was typing in a children's website, and she got one letter wrong, and she ended up on a porn site. And she was, and you can never take that back. Once your little child sees that, they can never unsee it. And I've had a lot of parents say, what about cleaning up that angle on pornography, that you can't have a pornographer own a children's site that is just one letter different where they could make a mistake like that? I mean, can things like that be dealt with too?
Yes, but you don't need a special law for that. You just go after that pornographer, charge him in any state in the union. Alabama, Mississippi, wherever, because that material that your daughter saw is available in any one of those states. And by court decision, the pornographer can be charged with their crime wherever their material is available. So go prosecute them.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was just dealing with a lady yesterday whose kids were molested by someone who had been involved. And, you know, they can go after the molester, but that molester feeding on pornography, what sites has he been on? Go prosecute those sites.
Yeah.
We have redress here. We have the law on our side. What's with our Justice Department? So, you know, Jeff Sessions is now gone, and I regret that he didn't prosecute pornography, but there's a couple people that have been mentioned as the next potential attorney general, one of which is a very prominent former federal judge, a woman, and I tend to think that women understand these issues better than men because pornography is primarily about the sexual exploitation of women.
Yes.
I'd love to sit down with that person and school them on the harms of pornography.
Yeah. Do you think that the time has come for the GOP to make a bigger deal about this again? Because in the Politico article, they try to say, well, Dianne Black tried that and it hurt her politically. Do you agree?
Not at all. What you have to understand is that pornography, child sex abuse, sex trafficking, sexual violence against women, these things are all linked. And this interconnection is very important to understand. sex trafficking doesn't happen in a vacuum. The sex buyers of those trafficking victims are all schooled on pornography. They're steeped in pornography. Pornography is used to train those trafficking victims. The same way with child sex abuse. So much of it is related to pornography. We've got a conference coming up on this. So people understand today, or can be made to understand, that the harms of pornography are very widespread. And once we understand that, the public is on our side on wanting to cut back on the influence of pornography in our daily lives.
Oh, that would be great. Would it help if more religious leaders would come out and fight the way somebody like Falwell fought years ago? Would that help the effort, do you think?
Yes, it would be. It would also help if more feminists came out. But we do need the church. Janet, if a man is suffering from the addiction to pornography, the last place that man goes for help is the church.
Yeah.
You look in the back of your church this week when you go, and you'll see materials available on a whole variety of issues, climate change, you name it. But you won't find something that'll help you get over a problem with pornography. You won't find something that'll help protect your family from pornography. The church has to get on board this issue. It is a moral issue, and it is affecting every family. And sadly, it's affecting many, many pastors, too. Mm.
Yeah, it's so true. The statistics are really overwhelming when you start looking at porn use inside the church, even among pastors, as you just said. It's overwhelming. It really is.
It's overwhelming.
Yeah, I mean, we're not going in a better direction by ignoring the problem. But you had mentioned before, Pat, that there is hope within the movement, even though we have not seen the DOJ come down as sharply as it should on this issue thus far. What kind of hope do you see on the ground with your group and maybe across the spectrum of people who are still fighting this?
I just am amazed at what's going on. You're probably familiar, or maybe you're not, with the website Reddit.
Yes.
Reddit is a site where they have a variety of forums. There's a few hundred thousand young men that are on a couple of these sites, and the purpose of the sites is to say, stop looking at pornography. Your life will improve, and you'll get over the problem that I just identified. And it's young men, and we bring these men into our conference. These are not religious leaders. These are just millennials who grew up with pornography and realized that it ruined their lives, ruined their chances of dating, ruined their chances of marriage, and they've decided to form large groups to alert the public, the young public, against this. So you've got that. We have more and more feminist leaders that are coming out against this, and they'll join with religious leaders at our summit. And we find that at our summit, we have people from across the board on religions, no religion, etc. I was involved in the previous movement against pornography, as you know, because I was with the Justice Department fighting this. And the movement today is nothing like that. It has all those people, but it's much more broad. And that's helping our movement. It gets the message across. When we went to Hilton hotels and asked them to get pornography out of all their rooms and all their hotels throughout the world, we weren't dealing with a religious leader there. It was a feminist vice president. And she said, I agree with you. I don't like the sexual violence. She went to work and got rid of it. When we went to Google to say stop selling porn ads to the porn industry, they sent out in their meeting at Google's headquarters all women executives. And they started fighting us, but after about 45 minutes, they were agreeing with it.
Hmm.
They don't want this. So, we have many more tools, but one tool that we have is the harm that pornography has caused that's so evident to people of any or no religious faith and people of all political beliefs.
Well, it's good. And talking to you, I get a little bit more hope than I did when I read the Politico article, because they pretty much said, give up. There's nothing to be done. Everybody's kind of thrown in the towel. But I think that it's really encouraging to hear what you're saying. And I would refer people to endsexualexploitation.org from the National Center on Sexual Exploitation, headed up by Pat Truman. Pat, thank you so much for being here and for the great work you do.
Well, thank you, Janet. God bless.
God bless you, too. We'll be back right after this.
This Janet Mefford Today podcast is sponsored by Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a nonprofit healthcare sharing ministry that allows you to control and manage your own healthcare and choose any doctor or hospital in the nation. If you're a freedom-loving American looking for contract-free healthcare, call now 855-585-4237 or go to libertyhealthshare.org. Welcome back to Janet Mefford Today. Is it ever justifiable to abort an unborn baby just because that baby has Down syndrome? Well, that is one of the easiest questions in the world to answer because it's obviously a resounding no, it's never justifiable. But Princeton bioethics professor Peter Singer, the man that bioethics expert Wesley J. Smith has called Professor Death, has argued to the contrary. In fact, he believes that aborting Down syndrome babies is justifiable and actually brings greater all-around happiness to individuals and families. Spoken like a man who does not have Down syndrome and is alive to make such insane statements. But joining us now is the man who recently debated Peter Singer as part of the Big Conversation series on Premier Christian Radio in the UK, Andy Bannister. He's a speaker with Sola Center for Public Christianity and author of the book, The Atheist Who Didn't Exist. Andy, it's great to have you with us. How are you?
I'm great to be with you too, Janet. I'm doing really, really well. Actually, just up here in Canada, where we're doing a big university mission at the University of Ottawa, where all these kind of questions are flying around. So great to be with you on the show to talk about some of them.
Thank you. Very exciting. First of all, I have to commend you because I'm not sure I could be with Peter Singer and not lose it over this issue. And I know when you're debating people, you have to keep it together. But tell us a little bit, if you would, about how this debate came to be and why you decided to do it.
Yeah, happy to. So Premier Christian Radio in the UK, and the wonderful thing in this age of the internet, that's accessible to anybody. You can just put them into Google and find them. Put on this thing called the Big Conversation, and the website for that is thebigconversation.show, and they got Christian thinkers and atheist thinkers together. And there's some quite big names in there. Daniel Dennett is in there, Jordan Peterson, you know, all kinds of folks. And then they approached me asking if I would have a go at having a conversation with Peter, because I've spoken a lot in the past on particularly things around human rights and dignity, Janet. You know, asking the question, you know, really, do those things make sense if atheism is true, or do those things really make more sense if Christianity is true? So I think they kind of knew that was my area. I've always admired isn't quite the right word, but, you know, Peter has been one of the big names you have to engage with and think about. So it was quite a privilege, actually, to sit down with him and have a conversation. And, you know, while I disagree with him profoundly, like you do, what I would say is, you know, I'd want to go on record as saying he's incredibly gracious, incredibly friendly. He's not an angry, rude atheist. He's willing to listen. He's willing to engage. I think, as therefore, as Christians, we are duty-bound to, you know, reach out to, and, I mean, Jesus said, love your enemies, right, and pray for those who persecute you. And Peter was willing to, you know, to have at it and have a friendly, robust conversation.
Well, that's good. You're exactly right. We need to reach out to those who don't know Christ, and he would be somebody who does need to know Christ. What is the essence of his argument, Andy, as you understand it, when he makes the argument that you can abort a baby who, through no fault of his own, has Down syndrome, or a little girl who has Down syndrome? How in the world can you justify murdering an unborn child who is simply physically not perfect, as if anybody is ever perfect, but he thinks that's okay? Well, how does he get to that point where he says that's okay?
Well, it's an interesting question, isn't it? And I love the way you framed it at the start when you said, you know, you wonder whether he has any people like that in his family. I mean, my wife and I don't. We have two, you know, really healthy children, you know, thank the Lord. But we have friends. We have two sets of friends, actually, who both have a Down syndrome child in the family. And they're amazing individuals. That's the thing I like about them.
Yes.
You know, amazing, amazing kids. And they've had some difficulties, but the joy they've brought and the abilities they have are astounding. So I do wonder whether Peter's actually sat down and talked with people. But that aside, what I would say I sort of commend Peter Ford to a degree. If he's trying to be an absolutely consistent atheist, and he's saying, look, if there is no God, and human beings are just atoms and particles, that's all that we are, just another cleverly evolved species, then the only way to navigate discussions around good and evil, because those things don't exist, they're just human inventions, is we need to ask what brings the greatest happiness to the greatest number of people. That's the position, philosophical position known as utilitarianism. And, you know, therefore, because of the stress and the anxiety and all the extra work that a Down syndrome child will take, it would be better overall if they weren't allowed into the world to make room for a healthy individual. Now, of course, there are all manner of problems with that. One of them, and we, you know, I'm sure you have others, but one, and I didn't do this with Peter on the day because we were, you know, we were trying to be a little bit polite, but I confess I thought of it afterwards, was I thought the problem with that, if I was placed with Peter again, I'd actually be a bit more sort of down to earth. I think I might say to him, you know, what about you, Peter? You know, you're in your 70s now. You know, you're filling up a place on the academic bench that, you know, a younger man, woman or man could take. So quite frankly, why don't we just let you out the door and make room for somebody else?
Right.
You know, we could get rid of one senior academic and make four young academics very happy. And from purely utilitarian grounds, you've argued yourself out of existence. That's the problem. Who gets to decide what is valued? And how do we set those criteria? And I don't personally want to live in a world in which we go around sort of saying, well, you know, you have a right to existence and you don't. I think that's gone some very dangerous directions historically.
Oh, for sure. So isn't it his position that certain people are not persons? And this is an idea that I know is spreading. There are more and more people in the field of bioethics, ironically, who will say you're not really a person until point X, but point X seems to continue to move.
Well, yes. I mean, I'd say a couple of things there as well. You're absolutely right. And something interests me there, Janet, is look, I don't think anybody actually murders or kills another human being. Well, by which I mean, the first thing you do is you redefine them. So we don't call it a baby in the womb, you call it a fetus.
Yes.
Or, you know, other sort of charming medical terms. In the UK, they, you know, our health service uses the term product of conception to talk about the thing that's in the womb. Because once you've called it, you know, given it a name, or you identify it as a person, of course, you then can't kill it. You know, Hitler, you know, famously, you know, dehumanized the Jews before doing what he did. And then in the Rwandan genocide, I forget which tribe was doing most of the killing to the other one, they labeled the people they were killing as cockroaches. They weren't humans. They were subhuman. And so I think the first thing we do is dehumanize. And I find that very, very worrying. But the second, of course, is where does personhood actually rest is a huge question. Because, of course, if it's just something that's arbitrarily given, I mean, that means presumably, by extension, the white supremacists who want to say that people who don't share his ethnicity are therefore not people. And all he's doing is the same extension as Peter and some of his other bioethicists are doing. You know, it's very interesting. There's a story in one of the UK newspapers just a couple of weeks ago about a very left-leaning liberal newspaper, but a journalist there who had had a miscarriage. And she told the story in her article of doing this, and she got very upset because the stillborn child was referred to by the hospital on a form or a letter somewhere as a product of conception. And she got desperately upset. This wasn't, you know, what a terrible dehumanizing thing. This is our beloved child. And it didn't take a rocket scientist to go, just a moment, that the child who was sadly born, you know, dead was, I think, 15 or 16 weeks. You could presumably abort at that stage.
Right.
So what is it that makes something a beloved, you know, infant that's been sadly, you know, delivered stillborn, and something we flush down the toilet? If it's just the will of a human being that's conferring personhood, we have a real problem. Because that means we can dehumanize whoever we want to for all kinds of criteria. Politics, race, gender, religion, nationality, all those have been done in history.
Yep. Right, exactly. Well, now, in an atheist worldview, what makes a person anyway? Who determines it? If there's no God, who gets to determine at what point you become a person? Is it just a movable target at all times and subject to the whims of bioethics professors?
Well, I think it largely is. And I think what's interesting, I think the only thing you can really do, and Peter actually goes this route and went this route in our conversation, by saying, well, you know, being a person means having a particular set of abilities. He talked about the idea to make plans and purposes and, you know, imagine the future and sort of set goals and head towards them. Other atheists and bioethicists have talked about, you know, ability to use language or to have conscience or consciousness or, you know, all those things you might pick on and say, well, if you have those particular set of skills, therefore you belong to the class human being. Problem of that actually was pointed out by an atheist, actually, Sam Harris. You know, new atheist, no friend of Christians. So the problem with that, of course, is that all of those things have a sliding scale of ability on them. And so if we say, well, you know, you have to display a certain intelligence to be a member of the human community, what are we saying for those stupid or the very young or so forth? And if we draw, in other words, if we make the criteria too tight, we exclude half the human race.
Yeah.
And if we make the criteria too generous, we start bringing all kinds of things in. And to which I would say to my atheist friends, Janet, look, the only place I know to ground personhood really securely and give us the foundations we're all looking for, you know, for justice and dignity and human rights. You know, here we are, 70th yes. anniversary year of the Universal Declaration. It's the teaching in the Bible that human beings bear the image of God, the Imago Dei.
That's it. Hang on a moment. We're going to go to a break. Andy Bannister with us. We're talking about whether or not babies in the womb who have Down syndrome should be aborted. We're going to come back. Stay with us. Hi, this is Janet Mefford. Imagine what it would be like if America were decimated by a civil war and millions of us had to flee for our lives. Imagine living in a crowded tent city with very little to eat, no education for your kids, and the threat of Islamic radicalization and sex trafficking all around you. Well, that's been the situation in Lebanon for several years now. In fact, 2 million of these refugees are living in tent cities in Lebanon, but there, they're finding the hope of Jesus Christ. That's been the situation because of our wonderful ministry partner, Heart for Lebanon. Heart for Lebanon is there among the refugees right now, offering the gospel of Jesus Christ, food to eat, and a Christian education for the many, many children who are in great need. At Heart for Lebanon's Hope Centers, little children like John are learning to read, getting nutritious meals, and hearing the good news that Jesus is his Savior. Not only are these children coming to know the Lord, but so are their parents. And when they go back home, they'll be taking the gospel with them to parts of the Middle East that many of us could never reach. Your gift of $22 will bring a day of food and Christ-centered education to 4 of these refugee children, while a gift of $98 will feed and educate an entire classroom full of children. That's 18 children for 1 entire day. We really need your help right now, so we're asking, call right now, 866-485-9187. That's 866-485-9187. Or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. Let's help create the next great Christian missionary force. The Lord is working in the hearts of refugee children in Lebanon, but we need your financial help. 866-485-9187. Again, your gift of $22 will bring a day of food and Christ-centered education to 4 refugee children. Please call now, 866-485-9187, 866-485-9187, or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. He has been called Professor Death. You know his name, Princeton bioethics professor Peter Singer. He was quoted as once saying, newborn human babies have no sense of their own existence over time, so killing a newborn baby is never equivalent to killing a person, that is, a being who wants to go on living. That doesn't mean that it is not almost always a terrible thing to do. It is, but that is because most infants are loved and cherished by their parents, and to kill an infant is usually to do a great wrong to its parents. This is somebody who does not think, obviously, with a biblical worldview, but he did have a debate recently with my guest, Andy Bannister, who's a speaker with Solas Center for Public Christianity. And we've been talking about this whole issue. The question that was on the table, is it ever justifiable to abort an unborn child just because that child has Down syndrome? And Andy, of course, we know that the abortion rate for babies diagnosed with Down syndrome is astronomically high. But you really nailed it before we went to that break. When we look at this issue as Christians, it comes down to the Imago Dei. It comes down to the fact that we are all created in the image of God. How do you drive that home to somebody like Peter Singer over and against his atheist worldview? Listen, we are created in the image of a creator. It's not up to us who lives and dies.
Yeah, well, I think that's a great question, Janet. I think obviously Peter would question the whole existence of God. He's an atheist, so you're working from that basis. But one of the things I was trying to do, I think, in that conversation was to sort of open up to him the inconsistencies in his own position. Because I think often our atheist friends who sort of play around with some of this, you know, quite nihilistic bioethics don't necessarily realize where it unpacks. And one of the places I thought was really interesting, where if listeners watch that interview with Peter at the bigconversation.show, you'll find there's a point in the interview where I sort of apologize to Peter for doing it, but I raised the issue of his mother, and in a sense I didn't feel bad doing it. It's on public record. He has written about it and talked about it. His mother died a few years ago and had dementia towards the end of her life. And one of the issues I think that's going on is Peter, you know, paid a lot of money for his mother to have very, very high, very, very good nursing care. And yet this is the same Peter who tells us that we shouldn't waste resources on things like that. We should give them to the poor. the euthanasia of the very old and the profoundly disabled and so forth is, you know, almost a moral duty. And so I looked at him and I said, Peter, there's an inconsistency here, isn't there? Because the way you treated your mother, and in fact there's a Jewish philosopher in the States has done written a very good critique of Peter. People can find it online, and the article is simply called Other People's Mothers. It's okay to tell other people to euthanize the very old or kill their young, but when it's your own. But Peter's response was basically to say, well, it's sort of different and complicated when it's your own. And I just looked at him and I said, yes, like, duh. And I think right. The thing that Peter misses, Janet, the thing I think he misses, and a lot of these bioethicists do, is they also miss the ethics and moral decisions and this kind of reasoning don't take place in a vacuum. Somebody said that Peter's a bit like Mr. Spock. He has this very sort of clinical, you know, analytical view of things. But actually, you and I know that if, you know, somebody has a child who's Down syndrome and so forth, that's not some sort of neutral thing. That's now within the context of family, and ethical decisions take place in the context of relationships. And I think he's missed that. And which brings back to the Bible, of course, and that foundation of the Imago Dei, the image of God there in Genesis, is crucial. But Jesus, I think, also sort of again and again stresses that it's how we treat the little ones, how we treat the weak. You know, if anyone causes one of the little ones to stumble, it will be better for them than a millstone being placed around their neck and then thrown into the sea. And I think Jesus would say it's how we treat the profoundly weakest among us that really tells us what we're like as human beings.
Yes.
It's that easy to treat somebody who's, you know, fit and able and well with the same abilities as me. Very easy to treat them with respect and dignity. Much harder to treat someone who's very different from me or who profoundly needs my help and who will be a drain on my time and resources and profoundly inconvenienced, which I would say welcome to parenthood, actually.
Yeah. Well, you know,
so I think Peter misses all of that nuance.
Yeah, I was finding this really interesting when you're talking about his mother and how well he treated his mother. Now, what would be an interesting scenario for me is to pose to him, and I don't know whether or not you said anything along these lines, but you, presumably Peter Singer treated his mother very well because, well, it's my mother. I love my mother. The relationship there is why I kept her alive. What would he say if he were out of the picture and it were up to a total stranger to decide whether or not his mother lived or died? I wonder if he would have a normal reaction to whoever's in charge of my mother, take care of her. In other words, would he apply the same moral standard on other people that he naturally displayed when he was faced with that situation?
That's a very good question. And I think it would make him profoundly uncomfortable because I sensed in that interview, Janet, he was trying to do his sort of reasoning at a distance. And the moment it was made personal, there the problems started. The other thing that I think he struggled with in that interview, the other thing I said towards the end to him, I said, look, it's interesting that from the point of view of Christian ethics, and actually other ethical systems too, but particularly Christian ethics, ethics is far more about character than it is about action.
Yes.
The word ethics comes from the Greek word ethos, which means character. And I think the New Testament, the biblical understanding, is far more concerned with what kind of people we are than just the deeds we do. You know, look at Jesus and the Pharisees. I mean, the Pharisees did all the good stuff, but Jesus had no time for them because their character was flawed. And what I was trying to say to Peter is, look, I'm not sure what it does to a person's character if you're looking around at the very weak and the very disabled and the very old. Rather than treating them with compassion, your first approach is, right, you know, are you close enough to death's door? Are you worthless enough that we can throw you off the cliff? Yeah, maybe not you, but maybe you're over the edge. I'm not sure what that does to us as individuals and as a society, when you begin cheapening life like that.
Right.
I think that has some paybacks on the person who's doing it, myself.
Well, right. And I think this is such an important opportunity that you have as an apologist to be able to create in people's minds a different scenario and perhaps challenge people like Peter Singer or people who agree with Peter Singer and say, you need to think about this differently. Where would you first go if you encounter somebody, not just Peter Singer, but somebody who maybe has been brought into this idea that Peter Singer has popularized, that until you're a person as kind of nebulously defined by the bioethics community, it's not really important to make sure that life is protected. When you talk about the Imago Dei, you start there. Where do you go next to talk about the sanctity of human life and why every person needs to be cared for? The weak argument is, I think, fantastic, but where else would you take that?
Yeah. Well, I think one of the first things I would do, Janet, when I'm talking to somebody is find the kind of group that they care about, because everyone cares about somebody. Some people are very young,
We look at the whole Me Too movement, you know, right yes. now, which I think is raising some very important issues around women and the way that they've been treated. So I'd start by trying to listen and engage the person in front of me, find out where they care, then push and go, well, you know, if you're an advocate for the whole Me Too movement, you know, maybe on a purely biological basis, it's okay to be misogynistic. And I'm looking for the reaction. I'm looking at the point at which they squeal. And then I can gently show, look, I think the Imago Dei is your, it helps you. But then we don't stop there. Then the question is, well, of course, the image of God then raises the question of which God are we talking about?
Yeah.
Because not every conception of God is the same. My PhD was in Islamic studies. And Allah, the God of Islam, is quite a different God from the God of the Bible.
Yeah.
But now if we're looking for a basis for treating one another with dignity and compassion, well, whose image are we made in? And now, isn't it interesting that we're made in the image of the God who cares so much that he steps right into history and takes on flesh and the person of Jesus goes to the cross? And here's the thing, right? God could have taken the euthanasia approach with you and I and the whole human race. He could have looked at us and gone, well, you have no value to me. You're a bunch of rotters. Look at the mess you've made of things. And so I'm just going to terminate all of you. God could have aborted the entire thing. He doesn't. Rather, he steps into space and time and history at great personal cost in the person of Jesus and goes to the cross. The cross wasn't convenient or easy. It was horrific and horrible and costly. And Jesus did that because of his compassion for us. And of course, the word compassion is two Latin words, com with passion, suffer. To have compassion means to suffer alongside. That's what God demonstrates for us in Jesus. And for us as Christians, you know, the command is to do likewise. That's where we look. But also, I would say, as humanity as a whole, what an incredible model for treating one another with dignity and compassion, because that God, whose image we are made in, has done that to all of us.
Terrific. I know, and it has to come back to the person of Jesus Christ, because if God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, while we were yet sinners, Christ died for the ungodly, we have to understand we're in trouble. And you're right. I think that was a great way to put it, that if we got what we deserved, we'd all be euthanized by God, and rightly so. That's the difference, is an unborn child has no say in being born or the chromosomes with which that child was formed. And, you know, we're guilty on all levels. So it's so important to go back to the gospel. Absolutely great. Well, Andy Bannister with us. Give that website out one more time, if you would, Andy, so people can watch this debate with Peter Singer, because I know people will want to see
it. Absolutely, Janet. So it's the website is thebigconversation.show. That's one of the new internet addresses, not .com, .show. Thebigconversation.show. And they can listen to me and Peter. And then there's lots of other great conversations between Christians and atheist thinkers on there that I think listeners will really enjoy. And share them with your friends. They're a great evangelistic tool.
Very good.
At work or with unsaved friends.
Excellent. Andy, thank you so much for being here. God bless you.
And you, Janet. Thank you.
All right. You take care. Thanks again for joining us on Janet Meffer Today. And we'll see you next time.